Yeah, yeah, a few plays here and there, and they're a good team, and you can't give them a few plays here and there. So, you know, they have an elite quarterback, they have an elite, you know, wide receiver group. So we're going to have to, you know, do our best up front to stop them from running the ball and not making our safeties feel like they have to play up, because they're a team that take a lot of shots, you know, deep with number 13. So, you know, our first and foremost, we got to stop the run and make them one-dimensional and then get after their quarterback and make him uncomfortable.
They've seen us just like we've seen them. So, I mean, it don't really help. But it's just another game, man. It's a playoff game. It's a big game. We're going to prepare as we didn't play them earlier in the season. We're going to prepare as we never seen this team before, and we're going to go over the game plan, get the game plan down, and execute it.
Well, they're committed to it. You know, I think Pep Hamilton, their offensive coordinator, does a terrific job. They use, you know, big people, big linemen, multiple tight ends, what we call 13 personnel. You know, you got some misdirection, trap type of plays. And you got mobile quarterbacks, you got the read option. I mean, you just, you know, there's so much they're capable of. I think, you know, their running back situation has been a little bit like ours. You know, they've Rolodexed it through there, and Heron 36 has, you know, kind of become, you know, their bell cow guy, and done a terrific job. Had a big game yesterday, both you in the passing game as well as the running game.
Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. Thank you for joining me. Today we have on our docket the divisional round. We also have a special guest, Arnie Stapleton of the Associated Press, is here with us to not only discuss the Broncos, as we all do, but he also covers kind of some national topics, the NFL in general. So he's got a little bit of a broader specialization in covering football than we do, though Mace, I think, is watching all games at all times, even when they're not on.
That's why you have a game rewind, and the, or in particular the 30-minute the condensed game option on NFL.com. That's kind of been a lifesaver for me.
And for today, we'll of course keep the best for last. So the Broncos will stay with our last segment of the day. We want to keep your attention for the entire duration. But we'll also be going in chronological order, starting with Baltimore-New England game, moving on to Carolina-Seattle in that late Saturday game, and then Dallas-Green Bay to begin Sunday, and then finally Denver and Indianapolis to finish up this round. To begin with Baltimore-New England, I mean, this was a game that a lot of people, you know, may have hoped was coming, but they couldn't really see Baltimore pulling it out in the wild card round, but they got a great defensive game against Ben Roethlisberger and the Steelers. Shut down their running game. Their own running game had a little bit of problems, not a whole lot of success, but they got the success they needed to when it mattered and pulled out that wild card win. As has been very notable is that they're a team that goes into New England and does better than some other teams might.
Yeah, two out of three wins in their last postseason, their last three postseason trips to New England. And, of course, it's not just in Foxborough where Baltimore has success on the road in the postseason, but really, I mean, in, you know, they've won at Miami, they've won in Denver, of course, in a game that a lot of Bronco fans would like to forget, in the postseason on the road under John Harbaugh. So, you know, to conceive them going in and beating the Patriots team, even as well as the Patriots are playing headed into the postseason, it's not a stretch to see them going in and pulling it off. And certainly, although Justin Forsett only had 2.5 yards a carry last week against Pittsburgh, it's still the kind of team that's equipped to go into to Foxborough, pardon me, and win.
That's right. And Joe Flacco, you know, he's got the most road victories in the playoffs in NFL history. And this week he was talking about how he doesn't understand why anybody would be intimidated by foreboding Foxborough or you know, the altitude in Denver, or for that matter, you know, anything else. He says it's nothing that crosses their mind. They have a different mindset, and it's led by Joe Flacco, but they have a bunch of different players. And fact of the matter is they just play sometimes better on the road, kind of like Dallas did this year, although mm-hmm. Baltimore has a deeper resume of having done that.
One of the things I think that Baltimore is going to need to do to be successful against New England is that running game. You can't beat New England alone in the passing game, it seems like. Their secondary is just too tough We saw in the last time that New England lost playing their entire starters, Eddie Lacy had a really great game for Green Bay. Forsett only had 40 yards against the Steelers. Do you think New England's defense is one that they can kind of get that game they need out of Forsett?
It is, but here's the key to it. They're going to have to take some chances downfield maybe early. Now, Ben, you know, you've spent time in Charlotte, so you know what kind of target Steve Smith was for the Panthers over the years. And you know that that just because you've got an elite cornerback on him doesn't mean he's not going to be able to go up and win his share of jump balls and make some plays.
Well, that was the entire premise of Jake Tulum's career at one point.
Exactly. But the deep ball is what Joe Flacco does best, I would say. He certainly throws a better deep ball than Jake Tulum did. No offense to Jake, who's still probably my favorite quarterback that I've ever covered and dealt with in my media career. But if you assume that the Patriots are going to put Darrell Revis on Steve Smith. You want your number one on their number one. And if Flacco tests that early and is able to make an early connection or two to Steve Smith against Darrell Revis, and maybe then you've got to have a little bit of help. You've got to have some safety help, perhaps, and that's one more guy that's out of the run defense equation. Then all of a sudden you're setting some things up to have some more lanes underneath and some more room for a Forsett to roam.
Now for New England, you know, a focal point of their offense, in the running game it's kind of like a mix. It seems like they don't really have a premier back. And so in the passing game it's really tight ends with Gronkowski, and then a little bit of, you know, mid to deeper stuff with like Edelman and stuff like that. Against the Ravens defense, Arnie, do you think that this is a game that Gronk really comes up big, that they really need him to succeed in that, in the seam and in the zone reads?
Absolutely. I don't know that right now anybody can stop Gronkowski. I mean, it's a matter of do you put two people on him? Do you put three? And then open things up elsewhere and hope to minimize the damage. I mean, he's having that kind of a year. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens there. But even when you put a lot of guys on him, they're not just going to use him as a decoy. You know, Gronk is hard to stop right now. And, TJ Ward,
firsthand.
Exactly. So
that was as fantastic a catch that I think I might have ever seen with that one-handed catch.
Yeah, back in week nine. Yeah, he doesn't make catches to that degree of difficulty with regularity, but it's just the way he gets open, the way he gets open down the seam, and the way he reads coverages, you know, off the snap, it's brilliant. I mean, he and Tom Brady are just in perfect concert with each other, and you look back at like last year when the Patriots offense did bog down once they got to Denver in the AFC Championship game. You know, they kind of got by and had some big performances without Gronkowski, but once he took the running game away from them last year and they didn't have Gronkowski on top of that, the offense struggled. Everything flows from him. I mean, you can go back the last 5 years and compare games with Gronkowski and without Gronkowski, and across the board, the Patriots are better in virtually every offensive metric. And teams have tried everything to try to stop him. They've tried, use a corner because the corner be quicker and has more speed. Use a linebacker, use a safety, use some combination, use double, even have three guys shadowing him, and he still makes plays. And if you put three guys on him, and then you've got guys like Edelman underneath and Brandon LaFell who's come on over the course of the season, it can make plays, and it becomes kind of pick your poison. The Patriots, I think Baltimore can hang with the Patriots, but I think with all those targets able to capitalize on any extra attention given to Gronkowski, I think the Patriots have too much for the Ravens to handle.
And with the Patriots as the top seed, and they've been especially a team who's come on really strong in the second half of the regular season. Arnie, what way do you think teams have to attack them to win a game, especially in the playoffs against that team?
Well, the Patriots, it's difficult because, like you said, he, both sides of the ball, they really have it going this year. And as we were saying earlier, Gronkowski's the perfect player to team up with Tom Brady at this point in his career. I know he does all the things to kind of turn back the clock with his body and his mind and everything, but the point of fact is he doesn't have the deep ball or the zip on the deep ball that he had, but it doesn't matter when you have Gronkowski. And then you've got that defense right now. Their secondary is just playing so well. You know, Brandon Browner will beat up guys. You know, I mean, he doesn't do it like Darrell Revis, but he's as effective because it gets to the point that the officials are only going to call the egregious holds, not the ones that are happening on every other play. So that becomes a positive, even though it's not a technically sound way to play cornerback in this league. But those two have really made a difference in New England this year. Obviously, with Gronkowski coming back, they're better on offense. But they've the two cornerbacks they got in the offseason has really kind of been the glue that's held that defense together.
Then we look at the other game this Saturday, and that's another one seed Seattle taking on the Carolina Panthers, a team who came into the regular season. A lot of people were counting them out at 7-8-1 for obvious reasons, but they really came on strong at the end of the season. Their rushing game has looked much, much better than it was earlier in the season. The defense has been playing well. They took out a weak Arizona team because they're on their 10th quarterback or something like that. So they come into Seattle, a team they've played close for the past few years, and until I would say yesterday, it looked like they had a good shot, and then Star Wotulelei had a foot fracture, and he'll be out for the rest of the postseason, it looks like. Is there still any chance that they get something going here?
There's a chance, but it's tough. Now you're looking at having to get the game maybe into the upper teens or 20s in terms of how many points the Panthers are going to need to win, and that's something they just haven't done in the last three games against the Seahawks, all of which were in Charlotte when Carolina's offense has struggled to move the football. The equation for them was basically having another stellar performance from the defense, another performance that contained Marshawn Lynch, that prevented Russell Wilson from getting some deep connections down the field to stretch the defense. That's what they were able to do for most of the last three games against Seattle. Now, without Lotulelei, I don't know if they're going to be able to contain Lynch up the middle, and I don't know if they're going to be able to get much of a pass rush without blitzing. And then that would expose some issues on Carolina's back end. The mountain is pretty tall, almost as Mount Rainier to climb now without Lotulelei.
Yeah, and I think the guy who's probably the saddest to see Lotulelei go down is Luke Kuechly, because Star was a big part of kind of clogging up the middle to allow Luke Kuechly to be Luke Kuechly and run all over the place. And as we know, this season, he was kind of the one that cleaned up the mess. It didn't matter what was going on in Carolina's defense. Luke was gonna clean it up, and that becomes much harder to do when he doesn't have Star up front to kind of allow him to move around and be where he wants to be. This is a huge loss for them, and I think Marshawn Lynch is going to be tough to stop anyway. Now it's going to be even more difficult. It's going to take one of those weird bounces, weird games like then the game turner last week with the Thigh Master interception. I'm just going to take something goofy like that, to get maybe a short field, some points or something, and maybe change the dynamic of the game.
And I think probably now it's going to be on Cam Newton to carry that team. I mean, what Carolina has wanted even before the Lotulelei injury, they want the ball in Cam's hands with 3-4 minutes to go and a one score deficit that they can overturn on one drive. And that, kind of the reverse was true for when they played back in October. It was Russell Wilson and the Seahawks that had the ball at about that juncture in the game, and they drove down for, the game-winning points in the game in Charlotte. So, instead of keeping it close with defense, now they're going to have to find ways to make plays throughout the game. Maybe with the running backs of Carolina being at their healthiest point, maybe you're doing a lot of zone read type stuff and using Jonathan Stewart, Tolbert, Fozzie Whitaker, D'Angelo Williams, you know, rotating them liberally and keeping them fresh and almost coming at the Seahawks in waves and kind of and using the zone read stuff to kind of to keep their speedy defenders in place and prevent them from wreaking the kind of havoc that they're used to doing just by keeping them off balance. That may be Carolina's best hope at an upset.
I see Seattle's offense wreaking some havoc of their own, just spreading out the linebackers. You look at the options they can run with Russell Wilson and Marshawn Lynch. You have to have someone spy Wilson a lot of the times. Thomas Davis can do that exceptionally well, who is having a fantastic year. But when you have to worry about Lynch getting through the first line, mm-hmm. And you have to worry about Wilson kind of running out of the pocket, it becomes a very difficult thing, and then they can find some underneath routes.
Yeah, and you would have also wanted, Kuechly to be involved in containing Russell Wilson as well, and now he's probably not going to be able to have that kind of freedom because he's going to have a lot more traffic to deal with up the middle. It's going to be tough. I mean, really, you know, Carolina was kind of on the precipice of, and when you have a 7-8-1 record, you're basically on the edge of, being a shaky team, and I think this might have pushed them over the edge. But you know what? Stranger things have happened, and there's been moments where Cam Newton has kind of taken those next steps. You know, when it seemed unlikely. Look back at the New Orleans game in December of 2013, when the Panthers are down. They're down to Dominic Hickson and Ted Ging Jr. as the receivers and in the rain in Bank of America Stadium, and Cam Newton marched them downfield. They're gonna for the game-winning score. They're gonna need another performance like that, where he just takes the team on his back and points the way. You know, we'll see. I think we'll know a lot more about Cam Newton after Saturday night.
I do think, regardless of how this game turns out, you have to kind of feel good about the young players on Carolina. That's really who's been driving the team at this point. I mean, you have like the young, experienced guys like Cam and Kuechly, but that secondary has a lot of young players outside of Roman Harper. They've been doing well. I mean, you have Greg Olsen doing well, who's kind of a veteran on the offense. They have some holes that they need to have filled in this offseason to improve. But as far as like a team that looked like they were trying to rebuild in this past offseason, make some significant changes, I mean, a playoff appearance with a win is not the worst you could do.
Playoff appearance with a win, and also considering the salary cap issues that they had, and then giving Greg Hardy the franchise tag and only getting one game out of him because of the domestic violence issues. They've trusted their young guys, their young draft picks, and some undrafted guys as well. Dave Gettleman, their general manager, has kind of been cleaning up a salary cap mess that he inherited from the Marty Herney regime. And, it's been a lot of duct tape and bailing wire. And here they are. I think everything is gravy for them. But that being said, they're 7-8-1. The other three teams in the NFC are 12-4. We're going to get to a couple of them in just a sec here. There's a pretty good gap between Carolina and Seattle and Green Bay and Dallas.
Yeah, it was nice to see them. They had six or seven rookies starting at one point. And I had a baseball coach in college that used to say, if you can win while you are learning, then that's the best case scenario, because that you learn how to win while you're learning to do everything else in the game. And you've seen players and teams that they learn to do everything, but they don't learn how to win. They don't learn how to close it out, Bengals being one of them. So that's a good sign. It might not be good this weekend for Carolina fans, but, when they go into the offseason, despite the fact that, people are going to say they backed into the playoffs with this sub-500 record, they got to be pretty happy about the future there.
And as you mentioned, Green Bay, they'll be the first game starting off on Sunday, taking on Dallas, who won a bit of a contested game with a few mistakes by the referees, as they have already admitted to a couple of them. in key moments coming down the end stretches.
But doesn't that just make it worse if you're Detroit, because they admit that they screwed up, but there's nothing that can be done about it. It's not like they were gonna gather at AT&T Stadium on Tuesday afternoon and pick up the game from where like the Pine Tar game back in 1983 of the Royals and Yankees, where they a month later after all the protests they picked up the game where it left off and replayed the and played the bottom of the ninth in front of I think like about 200 people at Yankee Stadium. Unfortunately, they're not doing that. Football doesn't have that sort of mechanism in it. So.
Especially just, during the playoffs.
It just
hurts. It just hurts.
It hurts, and especially for a team like the Lions, that for whom postseason wins are so rare. I mean, they have. You have to go back to 1991 against Dallas at home in the now abandoned Pontiac Silverdome when they for their last playoff win. If you're a Lions fan, it's tough to deal with. It's hard to swallow. And you think, you know, I don't lend any credence to conspiracy theories. I think sometimes the officials just mess up because they're human, and they make judgments that aren't necessarily correct at times. But I can actually say I don't blame the Lions fans for thinking something is up, because they're like, wait a minute, you know, but they'll get over it.
Especially because for the whole afternoon, it looked like Detroit was going to win that game. I mean, they were leading until 2:36 left, even after that play, and they had to punt on fourth and one. They were playing well all game, and it looked to the world like it was going to be, you know, Detroit was finally going to win a game and in the playoffs. And then for that to happen, it's not like it happened to a Peyton Manning or a Tom Brady, where you say, well, you know what, we're going to win 12 games next year and be in the playoffs again. We'll be, you know, it's like Kansas in the NCAA tournament. You know, this is like New Mexico State going to the NCAA tournament. If it doesn't happen.
Says the New Mexico alumnus.
Yeah. Well, I look back when a Michigan State kind of snuck by him and on a bad call in the closing seconds. And you know, Michigan State's there every year. They go to the Final Four every year, it seems. New Mexico State was like, man, that was our one chance for the next 20 years. It's kind of the same thing with the Detroit Lions, you know. Does that team, do the key players stay together?
Ndamukong Suh's probably gone. I mean, he sees the writing on the wall, and you know, got a little bit of emotional, actually, after that loss. I'm so surprised to see him that way in a press conference.
Yeah, I think, you know, he was crying afterwards, but there's going to be a lot more tears in Detroit as they watch this weekend. It's the Cowboys at Lambeau playing, because they know that the Cowboys probably shouldn't be
there,
still hanging around.
Well, regardless, it will be the Cowboys. They'll be taking on Green Bay with an injured Aaron Rodgers, who says he'll play, just a matter of how. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that offensive attack from Green Bay will be a bit hampered depending on how much that ankle hurts him. But as far as the defense, it's probably the best defense you want to face. As far as the Cowboys' passing defense is 25th in pass yards per play allowed.
25th and not a unit that generates a heck of a lot of consistent pressure. I mean, you know, give credit to Rod Marinelli for, you know, taking a lot of spare parts, and even in the case of Rolando McClain, a part that frankly looked like his career was done, and melding a competent defense out of that. And the question will be, what do you do? Do you try to pressure Aaron Rodgers, knowing that, you know, his mobility is compromised with that injury? If you do that, then you're setting yourself up for inside draws to Eddie Lacy and have him reach the second level pretty quick, and then also you're exposing yourself on the back end, and you know, Rodgers doesn't need much time and need much of a seam to make things happen. So it's, even with Aaron Rodgers' injury, I think Dallas's equation for winning this game is to get this into a shootout, contain Julius Peppers off the edge, prevent him from being able to get to Tony Romo, and Dallas being able to match Green Bay score for score.
Now, Arnie, you were talking about how well Dallas does on the road, but, I mean, you talk about Lambeau. That's probably as tough a place as you can play on the road.
Oh, that's right. And this is the first time in NFL history that an 8-0 road team is facing an 8-0 home team. Something's got to give, as they say. But Lambeau is a little bit more, you know, some of the guys this week were calling it the frozen mystique because it's not just the mystique of Lambeau Field, and they've got an incredible home record in the playoffs there. But it's going to be cold, and the Cowboys aren't used to that. And it does have an effect if you're not able to get into that shootout and kind of keep the, you know, the pedal, you know, pressed and give yourselves a chance. If you start to fall behind, you start to feel the cold a little bit. And then it becomes, you know, like any of these other games we've seen at Lambeau, by warm weather teams. You know, the Giants obviously can go in there and win. They've done it a couple times to deny the Packers a Super Bowl shot. But the Cowboys, they're not used to that. But having said that, they really play well on the road. It's maybe good for them to get away from their home stadium, as odd as that sounds, because nobody else this year was as good away from home as they were.
A lot of times that home stadium was a neutral venue. I mean, going down to Dallas last year, those of us who cover the game saw 25,000 Bronco fans, and they've had some games this year, like when Texans played in Dallas, I think there were about 35,000 Texan fans that came up from Houston, and they've had, you know, when the Giants come in, when Washington comes in, when Philadelphia comes in, it's simply, you know, road fans kind of take over that stadium. I think they're kind of glad to go on the road that at times they've had that chip on their shoulder, and if they can, you know, if they can carry it forward and pull off the upset in Green Bay, then that might, if Seattle wins Saturday, that sets Dallas up for a game that the Cowboys have already won. And that's the other thing: Dallas has the single most impressive win in the NFL this year, winning at Seattle, back in week six.
Yeah. And 30-23. I mean, the home teams this weekend are a combined 30-2. That matches the best for these foursomes in the divisional round over the last 10 years. It's happened two other times. One of them was a giveaway. New England's lost to Buffalo 19-7 on the season finale when the Patriots had already wrapped up the number one seed. And the other, Andrew, like you said, was Dallas going in there and winning. And I know it was during Seattle's 3-3 stumble, but that was a big part of the stumble, was that they lost at home to Dallas. And maybe you bring up a good point that maybe one of the reasons the Cowboys are so good away from home is that when they are at home, Tony Romo has to deal with crowd noise. Mm-hmm. And so he never gets the quietude of the home crowd. If he tries to quiet the home crowd like Peyton does when it gets a little too exuberant or inebriated here, it doesn't work there. You know, the crowd even gets louder. So he's used to the din of the noise. And so when he goes on the road, it's like, well, we've been doing this all year, even in the home games. So.
And there's something about Dallas's mentality. I look back at that Seattle game, and what impressed me was how, you know, they just attacked Seattle. They didn't, you know, there was no timidity to what they did. You know, they did what they do best. You get the ball to Dez Bryant. You get the ball to Jason Witten. Doesn't matter what kind of coverage they've got, and you keep running with DeMarco Murray the offensive line's a big part of that, especially with Murray. It's, you know, being able to create holes against a pretty stout front seven. But you know, Dallas plays on the road, plays a fearless brand of football that may well serve them well the next 2 weeks.
And the one thing that's really interesting with Tony Romo this year is you give him time, he does look like an elite quarterback. That's been the big debate over all these years because he didn't have the postseason success. But both of those teams, the Packers and the Cowboys, offensive lines give their quarterback more than enough time to find the targets. I've often wondered this season if Peyton Manning had either Dallas's line or Green Bay's line, what kind of numbers could he have put up? Because he put up incredible numbers this year. Even when they downshifted the offense, changed the offense, he still, at the end of the year, was one of the top three quarterbacks in the league. and he did it without having the space or the time to step into his throws, and Peyton needs that. And Tony Romo and Aaron Rodgers enjoy that. And so that, to me, is maybe a glimmer of hope for Cowboys fans that they can get into a shootout, because you'll have – it will be the Romo show and the Aaron Rodgers show. And Aaron Rodgers hasn't thrown an interception at home since forever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an NFL record. 418 passes this year. He hasn't thrown a pick there since December 2012. 36 touchdowns, no interceptions. He doesn't make mistakes. But Tony Romo's pretty good, too, when he's got all that time in the world.
And then with that, I think that's a great place to go on to the late afternoon game Sunday. And, of course, that's the one that we're all going to be witnessing here in Denver, and that's Indianapolis Colts at the Denver Broncos.
It's a rematch. Someone who started the season will be going home facing the same people they started against. Obviously, the Broncos took that first game, 31-24. They did go up early, the Broncos did, before Indianapolis tried to rush back late with a few scoring drives in the second half. Couldn't do that. They were stopped on fourth down late in the game, and that pretty much ended it. But these are two completely different teams. Well, not completely different, but both offenses look different. You have different personnel. C.J. Anderson's now the premier back for the Broncos. You have Daniel Heron, Boom Heron, starting in the backfield for Indianapolis. Trent Richardson, I don't think he even got a carry the other day. They say he has an illness, but he just hasn't been as effective as a back.
He wasn't doing well when he felt well. So, I mean, Heron's been an upgrade for them, particularly in what they like to do. Which is put the game in Andrew Luck's hands and give him another target. And Heron had 10 receptions against the Bengals last Sunday, and that really kind of has that has a lot of weight going into this game, because we've seen the last few weeks since the Broncos lost Brandon Marshall and Dane Trevathan to injuries. Of course, they're hoping to get Marshall back this week. He's been practicing this so far this week, but without those two guys, you've seen the Chargers, the Bengals, and Raiders all have some good plays, and in the case of the Bengals and the Raiders, some explosive plays, 20 plus, with Gio Bernard and Latavius Murray catching the ball out of the backfield. So, you know, that's something the Broncos are going to have to be on guard for, and that's just another issue to consider against a quarterback who trusts all his targets. And even though, you know, T.Y. Hilton's kind of the alpha of the group, you know, Luck will spread the ball around. He'll get the ball to his tight ends, and he'll get the ball to Heron. And so there's a lot of questions for the Broncos to answer on the back end.
There certainly is. And the thing with that I find interesting about Andrew Luck is he's accounted for 84.5% of the yards from scrimmage this year, which is kind of funny, because Jim Irsay last year, if you guys remember, kind of said, you know, we didn't have enough Super Bowl rings and the Star Wars numbers that Peyton put up, you know, all that whole storyline. But the basic thing he was saying was he didn't have a balance. He didn't have a great defense, good special teams, good ground game. But now he's leaning on that team is leaning on Andrew Luck more than that team ever leaned on Peyton Manning when you look at the numbers. And in an oddity, Andrew Luck and Jim Irsay and the Colts come here, and they see the kind of team that Jim Irsay wanted, a team that has the ability to spend money on defense, has a star-studded secondary, a bunch of Pro Bowlers, special teams that's gotten better over the last month with Wes Welker and with Omar Bolden kind of taking over, and then obviously with the grinding ground game that the Broncos kind of downshifted into. They have the balance that Jim Irsay was pining for last year when he was complaining right before he got into Manning's head on the homecoming game last year.
You know, and it's interesting to look back at the Super Bowl that Peyton Manning and the Colts did win together in 2006. And I know Manning does not like to make the comparisons to that time, but that Colts team, you know, Manning was not good in the playoffs. He had, I think, was three touchdowns. I believe it was seven interceptions in the four games of that postseason. But you know, Joseph Addai and Dominique Rhodes combined to average 4.4 yards per carry. so they had an effective running game that took the pressure off. And that defense, you had good pass rushing, but on the back end, a guy that a lot of people have kind of forgotten about, but people have to remember how good Bob Sanders was before injuries took their toll, took the toll on him on the back end. That was that the year he was defensive MVP, 06? Yeah, tremendous back in those days. And a good comparison between these two teams on Sunday is, you know, the Broncos changed their offensive emphasis after 10 games, after the 56 pass plays, 10 runs game in St. Louis. They've had a 50% run, 50% pass play calling balance in the last six games, and they've actually averaged eight-tenths of a point more per game as accounted for by the offense than they did in the first 10 games. The question is, could the Colts have reshuffled their offensive deck in the same way the Broncos did? If the Colts went for balance, I don't think they'd be sitting here right now in the way that the Broncos are, with an offense that in some ways is more efficient than it was before and has also kind of helped the defense out, because the offense has been able to extend drives, take its time, and give the defense some breathers, which is something that some defensive players, including Chris Harris recently, have talked about as really helping them out.
As far as the rushing game, CJ Anderson was a player who had a lot of success against Indianapolis in that first week, only on four rushes, but he had 27 yards. And now he faces the Indianapolis defense again, who on the season ranks 23rd in yards per play allowed on the ground. And you also look at turnovers. The Colts have been, I don't think this is overstating, but they've been pretty bad turning the ball over and not so great in taking the ball away. Daniel Heron has had two fumbles in the postseason just in that one game, two fumbles in the regular season. He's lost three between all four of those. If he fumbles the ball here, this is a time you can't do that. And you also look at the fumbles that Andrew Luck has. He's been sacked about, I think it's 29 times, lost six of those, lost six fumbles. And so if you can get that pressure to him and kind of get to him, you might be able to punch that ball out. I was watching the game against the Bengals. Heron kind of carries that ball loose sometimes. The turnover battle is going to be big here. Raheem Moore had two interceptions on Luck in that first game. How the defense can get the ball back in the offense's hands is going to be a key point of emphasis.
Yeah, you mentioned Heron. I mean, he's his fumble rate is what concerns the Colts. Even though, I mean, he's able to make some plays and he's been dynamic, but in the last seven games, he's fumbling the ball once every 32 touches, which is an unacceptably and unsustainably high rate. And, that's to me, it's a concern. You look at the Colts overall, they're, for the season, they were tied for 29th in the league in turnovers, and 29th, I mean that negatively, because they had 31 giveaways. Certainly, if you're the Broncos, your equation for defensive success, you're going to give up some yards, but you've got to be able to force a couple of takeaways. And I think if the Broncos can do that, whether it's from Boom Heron or from intercepting Andrew Luck as they did back in Week One, or from pressure on the backside, forcing the ball, on a blindside pressure, forcing the ball loose from Andrew Luck, that's what they need in order to win.
That's right. The thing with Andrew Luck is he has that uncanny knack to win games. As we saw last year against Kansas City, they fall behind by 28 points and they win. So there's never any taking your foot off the gas against these guys. You get up big, it doesn't matter, you keep going, because Andrew's the kind of guy that can, kind of like a John Elway back when John was in his playing days. It doesn't matter what's going on around him. He can rally the team. So Terrence Knighton, Von Miller, DeMarcus Ware have all talked this year about they don't want to ride Superman's cape. They want to be the reason that Denver wins. This is the chance for them to be the reason that they advance to the championship game in the AFC, because they're facing a great quarterback and they're very healthy, unlike last year when they went into the playoffs with Jack Del Rio had put him with sticks and glue, it seemed like, and tape to get him
And then it got worse when they lost Chris Harris Jr. when in the first playoff game. I mean, it just seemed like it never ended.
That's right. And the fact that Gronkowski was out of last year's playoffs, I think, helped having the game here, the championship game here last year helped, because really, let's face it, when Chris got hurt, San Diego almost came back and won that first game. It would have been like the Buffalo debacle all over again, you know, losing at home as a top seed in the first in your first game in the divisional round. But Chris's loss may have been the one that broke the camel's back ultimately, as we saw at the Super Bowl. And you had Chris, Raheem, Derek, Vaughn, Kevin Vickerson, all in street clothes on the sideline watching the wrenching loss that unfolded.
Well, with Harris in particular, I mean, if he had been injured one quarter earlier against the Chargers, then maybe what we're talking about right now is this team trying to overcome losing two consecutive divisional playoff games at home. Because when he went out in that game and, you know, Quentin Jammer came in, you know, you could almost see Philip Rivers' eyes get as big as dinner plates, and he started throwing right at Jammer repeatedly, and that's where the Chargers' comeback began. So, yeah, even though you've got the Marshall injury to consider, and they're already without Dan Trevathan, and they're already without Nate Irving, that's still a far sight from last year when you can just go rattle off, you know, Vaughn Miller, Harris by the postseason, out without Champ Bailey most of the year. Raheem Moore was out by the postseason. Derek Wolfe, it was, you know, it's looking a little bit better now.
Yeah, this year, if you look at the starters, Danny Trevathan really is the only one that they were counting on who is done, and they were counting on big things from him. And Brandon Marshall stepped up and kind of eased the pain of that. So really, this is the healthiest team, I think, of the eight teams left in the playoffs. The Broncos had 100% participation this week at practice for the first time since October 3rd. They were in pads Wednesday for the first time since, I think, it was December 11th. So this is a healthy team, and they have to use those fresh legs and their clear minds to their advantage this weekend and really get rolling. The other thing that I remember about the San Diego game last year was when it looked to all of us like Philip Rivers was going to lead that comeback, when the Broncos had the chance to salt away the game, Peyton Manning looked to Julius Thomas, and they did. They salted away the game with some key third down catches in the fourth quarter. One of the keys this weekend is going to be, you know, is Julius Thomas the guy that we saw in the first half of the season when he scored 12 touchdowns, or is he the guy that he was in the last half of the season, which was basically MIA, three catches, you know, 60-plus yards, no touchdowns? That's going to be a huge key in the offensive aspect for the Broncos this weekend.
One of the things you talked about is the third downs. You talked about last year. This year, the Indianapolis defense, though they're without some, you know, stars on the defensive side outside of Vontae Davis, who's been an exceptional cornerback, they're kind of without a lot of players there, and yet they're still a top five team in both third down conversions allowed and fourth down. So they kind of put it together when they need to, though they don't really do a great job in a per yardage or per play yardage kind of aspect.
They do, and they do get some sacks. I mean, obviously the loss of Robert Mathis really hit them hard. And I think in week one they were still trying to figure out, how do we get pressure without our bell cow in the pass rush? And it's been kind of a collaborative effort. You see, you know, Eric Walden can get some pressure off the edge. Corey Redding, you know, working as a 3-4 end can get some pressure inside. And Bjorn Werner, their first-round pick back in 2013, has done a better job getting pressure. They're actually, you know, they've got one. Obviously, they're very good in third-down defense. They're also very good at getting sacks. If you look at their sack rate, it's actually ninth in the league, one per 14 pass plays. So they can make some things happen.
That's where Chuck Pagano, I'm sure, is looking at. The one area he can exploit is this Denver's offensive line. And even though he doesn't have Mathis, like you say, Andrew, they can generate enough to put pressure on Peyton and maybe make him uncomfortable, which then leads to those mistakes, or it leads to those three and outs, or, you know, those drives that stall. So the offensive line here is going to have to step up big. I know they were starting to gel in the at the end of the season, and they can do some things to kind of make that happen on Sunday, and they're going to have to do it early, you know, some pulling, some running, to just kind of get them on the offensive instead of the, you know, backpedaling all the time, because otherwise the Colts pass rush can still make it a difficult day for Peyton.
I think Arnie said it very well in wrapping it up. You know, you got it. You know, that pass rush can cause some problems, and, you know, the Broncos offensive line has, you know, played better, but you know, you've got Orlando Franklin coming off a concussion, so, and he's probably been the best offensive lineman for the Broncos in the last several weeks, so, you know, we'll see.
And with that, that'll end our podcast this week. That game, Denver versus Indianapolis, is at 2:40 Mountain Time. Be sure to head to the game if you have tickets. We don't want to see any empty seats, and of the full seats, we want you to be wearing orange. So thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, and we'll see you next week.
You know, their O-line's changed. Our O-line's changed. You know, it was a tough opener. They're a very, very good football team. You know, we've been to the playoffs 3 years in a row, and got as good a young quarterback as there is in the league. You know, that much of that has not changed. I mean, statistically over the stretch, they're, if not one, I think top three in the league. So they're very capable, and when you get to the Elite Eight, you usually are.
I mean, we've grown so much as a unit, not only just as a secondary, but as a defense total. Like, I think you're going to see two different teams completely from the first game of the season, us and them.
And it's something we developed throughout the season, was having that killer instinct to put teams away and not giving them, you know, any hope. And that's something, you know, if we're up in the game, that's something we'll reiterate. And if we're down in the game, we'll, you know, it'll also be something that, you know, that we talk about on the sideline, as far as keep fighting and have that mentality to never stop playing. So, you know, regardless of what the scoreboard is, we're going to continue to play hard for four quarters.
Well, I think what's unique about Andrew is he's, you know, not just mobile. You know, he can make the throws. You saw the throw he made yesterday, stepping up into the pocket. He's big, he's strong, he's physical. You know, he's just not a little scat back type. You know, he's got the playing strength to go along with the mobility. So I think he's unique that way. And I think, you know, what he's accomplished, you know, maybe better than any quarterback has ever accomplished early in a career to date. So, you know, I think he was pretty highly touted that way, and I think he's been as advertised.
Like, he's like Ben Roethlisberger, man. Like, them great quarterbacks, they can extend downs. You think that, oh, man, Vaughn got him down. Well, then he slip out of a tackle and then throw a deep shot. Now it's a game changer. So we definitely got to be ready for just anything, because, you know, he's that great.
But, you know, he's one of the elite quarterbacks in the league, you know, a Pro Bowler, perennial Pro Bowler, probably be for the rest of his career. But, you know, quarterbacks are average when you get a lot of pressure on them and, you know, you hit them and, you know, make them uncomfortable in the pocket, and that's what we're going to try to do.